This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Jim Martin was the first and only two-term Republican governor in North Carolina. He served in that role from 1985 to 1993. But his road to public office was different from many other politicians. Grew up in South Carolina, the son of a Presbyterian minister. The family rarely talked about politics, and he pursued a career in chemistry. It wasn't until he was getting his Ph.D. at Princeton that politics appeared on his radar. Started reading conservative magazines and was drawn to the idea that partisan competition was essential for a healthy political environment. His political inquiry continued to blossom and eventually led him to 26 years in public office, including time on the Mecklenburg County Commission and 12 years in Congress. The new biography, Catalyst, Jim Martin and the Rise of the North Carolina Republicans, documents this story and the changing political landscape in North Carolina for the past five decades. We will be joined later by the biography's author, John Hood. But first, we're joined by former Governor Jim Martin. What a pleasure, Governor Martin. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Take us back to those early years, born in Savannah, South Carolina.
Savannah, Georgia.
Yeah. But you grew up in South Carolina.
I did, in Winnsboro, a small town just north of Columbia.
What do you remember about those early years?
Well, I remember we lived next, don't remember much of anything about Savannah. We moved when I was about 2 years old. And we lived next door to the Presbyterian Church on Washington Street in Winnsboro, and that gave us access to the pianos and the parlors over at the church, and all of us enjoyed music.
Your father was a minister, right?
Yes.
And
mom was a preacher's wife.
And that is a role. That is a job.
Which takes care of the discipline side of it, yeah.
So what kind of influence did that have on you, do you think?
Well, it meant that I knew where I was supposed to be on Sunday morning.
That's right. And so did everybody else in
town. Not in the recreation room playing ping pong either. Mm-hmm.
What drew you to chemistry?
Well, you know, partly it's the fact that you can't see the atoms and molecules, and a lot closer today with electron microscopes and X-ray diffraction and X-ray crystallography, I should say. But back then, you had to figure it out from wet chemical methods, that you get a certain product that would lead you to some conclusion as to what had to be there before. And that appealed to him. But, you know, the main thing was personal influence of our principal, who was my football coach, Monk Price, who also taught chemistry 1 year and physics the next and chemistry the next and so on, so that I took one from him in my junior year. My older brother Bubba was in that physics class his senior year, and then the next year I took chemistry. And then I decided that's what I wanted to do.
What were you hoping to do with it? Did you imagine that you'd be teaching?
Didn't really know, I guess, if you go back to that stage, but when I was at Davidson, I decided I did not want to go into medicine. I did want to go into chemistry as a teacher and applied for a fellowship to Princeton that I did win, helped me to get through there.
It was there at Princeton that you say you got interested in politics. Is that right?
There was one of my friends there in the chemistry department, Bill Purcell, was a physical chemist. And, you know, we palled around a little bit, and I asked him about the magazine he was reading, and he showed it to me. It was National Review. And I began to realize that that was the best reflection and interpretation of what I felt about politics. Mainly, I thought that local governments should be free to exercise their responsibility, but also should do it, should tend to problems rather than wait on the federal government to usurp that.
Now, that was a time, that would be the early 60s?
Yes, 1960 was when I decided to register as Republican, mainly because I thought we needed a two-party system in the South. You know, one voter at a time was all I had in mind at that time. That was well before the Blackberry Farm conference that is featured in the first few pages of the book.
Well, we'll talk about that in a second.
But back then, you know, most Southern conservatives were Democrats.
They were also talking about local control. I mean, that was a big issue in the South. Local control meant change in the Jim Crow laws.
Yeah, they meant local barriers against federal intrusion.
Right.
My view was local control, meaning that you actually deal with the problems.
So you decided,
a little difference, yeah.
What was it like? Because the idea of winning an election in North Carolina as a Republican must have seemed preposterous in that time, or did it to you?
in 1960?
Yeah.
Well, we did have a Republican congressman, Charlie Jonas.
Right.
He was the only one for years, and then when they tried to redistrict him, that led to Jim Broyhill being elected. When they tried to redistrict the two of them again to take away their Republican voters, those Republican voters, when other districts elected other Republicans, Wilmer Mizell Congressman Ruth, Earl Ruth from Catawba College.
So it was certainly possible to win in electoral politics, but in terms of influence, how did you see your mission, and how did you see your becoming a Republican in the state of North Carolina? Did you imagine that you could have that kind of influence?
About all I was doing, Frank, in those early years was trying to help the precinct to get a few more votes for the Republican. We had a shoebox with index cards that were marked on the edge as to whether they'd voted for President Eisenhower, for Congressman Jonas, for the candidates for Jack Stickley for governor. Mm-hmm. And if the more marks they had on the edge in that pattern, the more likely they were to vote for Republicans. And so I had a student Republican club that started making calls to those people before the election to get out the vote. So that instead of losing by 4-1, Mr. Jonas would only lose by 2-1.
But you're making progress.
Yeah, well,
and you changed the system. I mean, in a way, this is a system you devised or helped to devise, first by generating the club and then coming up with a way of keeping better track.
But I thought that was a good way to contribute.
Yeah. Then you decided to run. Talk about the decision to actually run.
I ran for town council,
right?
And I thought I could win. And one of my colleagues, a senior member who was on the town council, J.T. Kimbrough, was a math professor. He came up to me in the faculty lounge, and really it was the post office, but we call it a lounge. But he came up and said, "I understand you're going to run for town council. You understand we don't campaign overtly. We just rely on people who know us to support us." I figured that'd work. And I counted in the phone book that I could get, 120 or so, 140 maybe, people who would vote for me. And in the past election, that'd been enough. But not that time. There were some bond issues for sewer pipes and all, and a bigger turnout, and I lost. I got more than I'd counted on, but not enough to win.
Well, I wonder, was it the bond issue that generated a higher turnout, or did you think in some ways you'd been had with that advice?
No, he was a genuine person, was a friend. I'd had mathematics in his class.
I see.
So we were friendly. No, I just decided that if I ever ran again, I would not follow that advice.
The phone book would not be your advisor.
Right. I'd start making a few calls, yeah.
You were recruited to run for the Board of County Commissioners, and you won that election. You also, during your tenure, you addressed a racial conciliation rally in Charlotte. Can you tell us a bit about that story and how significant that?
Yeah, you're speaking of when Reverend Martin Luther King was assassinated, and there were many cities across the country that burst into flames with that, and Charlotte did not. I was county commission chairman, and the mayor and I were involved in organizing an event at the Ovens Auditorium, about a 2,000-seat place, and it was a big rally. And I, in a way, agonized as to what was the right thing to say, not just to get up and say something nice, "I'm sorry this happened, it never should have happened," or something like that. Everybody knew that. But I decided that was a time to make a case for local government to meet its responsibility properly to its citizens with regard to open housing, it was called then. It's a very hot issue. Congress was fighting over it, and so I proposed that local government, Mecklenburg County, should take the lead in enacting ordinances that would allow people the freedom to live where they chose to live.
That had to be a controversial issue
big
in Mecklenburg County in 1968.
Martin for open housing. I'm sure the newspaper thought they were flattering me or commending me with that.
Did that? What's the outcome of that? What kind of impact did that have on you? You're taking a big risk in doing it, and
Immediately I heard from people who said, you weren't what we thought you were, and we won't support you again. And yet, with time, people began to realize that was not as damning. I mean, Americans should be able to live where they choose. So I guess maybe having said it, at least some people began to think that, maybe it's time to do that.
You served 12 years in Congress. You were in the minority. Your party was in the minority the whole time. Tell us about that experience and what effect that had on you.
Well, it kind of wears you down after a while. I know the first couple of years we would get a lift, a spiritual lift, driving over the South Capitol Street Bridge. You come over the river there just south of the Capitol, and you'd come over, and sure enough, the Capitol Dome would rise up out of the top of the bridge as you ascend up on it, and we'd have the radio or the little tape player doing Pomp and Circumstance. And we'd time it just right where to key it up. But after a while, it did kind of wear me down. That first year, though, as you remember, after 72, was pretty much dominated by the Watergate hearings, right, and all of that. And here I was, a Republican who had campaigned very hard with and for President Nixon. Mm-hmm. And I remember I'd hold my index finger, middle finger up, and hit that V that he mm-hmm. and Churchill favored. You know, where that actually originated was in the Roman Senate when they'd send out for five beers. You out there in radio land will have to hold that up and see what I'm talking about. But I said, a vote for Martin is like two votes for Nixon. And here the man was in trouble. And at first, I took the view that I couldn't make a decision without having sworn evidence, not just rumor and innuendo. But ultimately concluded that he had erred very severely with the cover-up.
We're going to take a break right here. Former Governor Jim Martin is with us. The new book, Catalyst, Jim Martin and the Rise of the North Carolina Republicans. We'll also be joined by the biographer, John Hood, on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about the new biography, Catalyst, Jim Martin and the Rise of the North Carolina Republicans. It documents Jim Martin's 26 years in public office and how North Carolina's political landscape has changed in the last 50 years. And former Governor Jim Martin is with us. We're also joined now by the author of the biography, John Hood. John's a political commentator and president of the John William Pope Foundation. John, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have
you. Thank you very much, Frank.
Tell us how you got involved in this project.
Well, it's a fascinating story, a story of a particular leader and also of the rise of two-party competition in North Carolina. I was privileged to tell the story. But honestly, just like a lot of trouble I get myself into, this started with my mouth. Governor Martin and I were on a board together. He asked me about some proposals that had been made to do a biography of him. A lot of times when you have people in public life, folks will propose commission biographies. The politician will pay someone to write the, which is a fine system for getting a lot of interesting information out there. But I thought that his life in particular justified an independent project he would cooperate with but wouldn't commission, and a commercially published book. And as I explained my views about that to him, I found myself, I guess, talking myself into doing this project. So that's how we ended up with it.
You were a stranger and I took you in.
Kind of.
Well, not exactly a stranger, certainly. But let me ask you this, though. I think one of the stories that the book tells is about the rise of the Republican Party. This had been a one-party state, as much of the South, solid South, Democratic autocracy in many ways. And so how do you explain, and I will certainly talk to the governor, but from your point of view, having researched the book, that competition, what was Jim Martin's role in making the Republican Party viable in the state?
Well, it was critical, and it wasn't as if this didn't occur in other states. In every state, you had some leaders in the Republican side and conservatives who performed these similar roles. In North Carolina, the way I argue it in the book, and of course this issue of Republicans in the South and the rise of the party has been told a number of different ways, but my take on it is that there was a two-step process. You needed, if you were a Republican in an overwhelmingly Democratic state, or I suppose the other way around in a different situation, you need to detach the voters from the other team, and then you need to attach them to your team. And you need to do both things. I argue that there were politicians in North Carolina, Jesse Helms being the most obvious example, who specialized in the business of detaching voters from their perhaps natural or historical home in the Democratic Party by arguing that the party had left them, by using, this is where the term wedge issues come from, that you're going to go in and you're going to wedge a voter out of his or her traditional party and bring them over to your side. And so Helms, I think, mastered the art of detaching voters from the Democratic Party on a variety of matters and in a variety of ways. But it's not enough if you're going to build a party that can be competitive, not just for presidential electoral college votes or U.S. Senate or maybe even Congress, but actually be competitive for governor, for county commission, for mayor, for state legislator. In those cases, voters are not just looking for someone who shares their values. They're looking for someone who can solve their problems and who can deliver services that they believe in, things like public safety and education and transportation. Environmental protection. So Republicans had to attach those voters by having messengers, having leaders who actually articulated ideas, positive agenda items, and that's what Jim Martin did in North Carolina.
Well, talk a little bit more about that, because Jesse Helms was successful at creating these wedge issues and telling voters why, what was wrong with the Democrats and for a variety of issues, race being among them, and worked on that resentment. But he won statewide office. As a senator, he got votes from all over the state. What was it, Jim Martin, that you felt was, why did you think the second step had to be taken if you would be successful running for statewide office like governor?
Well, to an extent, this came out of a conference at Blackberry Farms in Tennessee, in the mountains there. Just after I was elected, I came to know and admire Lamar Alexander, who then was governor of Tennessee. And we talked about, how do you get people to vote for Republicans down the ballot, you know, for county commission, for sheriff, for legislature, for judge, people who would vote for us or would vote for Nixon, would vote for Eisenhower, would vote for Republicans at the top of the ticket for Senator Helms. But then when they got to down the ballot, there were so many names that they didn't recognize, they just go back to their party and pull the party lever when they got away from the top of the ticket. And so we invited a group from various southern states. Carroll Campbell was a congressman just before he ran for governor in South Carolina. Newt Gingrich from Georgia. Connie Mack from Florida. John Sununu was there. We'd known him, though he was not a southern governor. He was there. He and Dick Thornburg were representing the Republican from other states. Mm-hmm. And the Republican Governors Association. And we had a pollster and an ad agency guy there, and they would give us some information in the first 50 minutes, and then we'd go out and pitch horseshoes, and we'd come back and we'd talk about that. And the thing that, I guess the most important thing that came out of it was that in addition to wedges, we needed magnets to draw people to the party. We had to show that we could do something, that we could govern, that we were not just against the majority party, but given the chance, and when we were in office, we needed to show that we could govern and build a record that could serve as magnets. I think Carroll Campbell was one of the first to move that on a statewide scale, and then others of us sharing ideas as to how to do it had an Operation Switch in North Carolina, and that got a large number of people to come over and move their registration to where their mind was.
How did that play out, though, when you were elected governor, elected in 84, and you had a hostile legislature? They were controlled by Democrats in the House and the Senate. So how did that play?
They didn't like that.
They didn't like that? Yeah. They didn't like you, at least you and your position. I don't know how they felt about you personally. Gave you a hard time.
They liked me personally.
How did that play out in terms of public policy? Talk about the relationship you had with the legislature.
You know, I had served in the minority on the county commission and with one time in the majority, a couple of times in the majority, but in Congress was always in the minority. And I knew we had to work with the Democrats to get occasionally some things included in a bill. As governor, I'd assumed that I could work with the legislature and came in there intending to do that. Saw no need for a veto at that time, but
we should point out the governor didn't have a veto
right.
When you came into
office. I was the only governor
office.
In the United States that did not have the veto of any kind. And yet, within days of taking office, the legislature started moving to strip authority from the governor as quick as they could. They couldn't do it before we all took office because they had, I guess, assumed that Rufus Edmiston, their candidate, would win. And that didn't work out for them, and so they decided they would weaken the governor's office even further. And we'd have to go to court to defend the responsibilities of the governor.
Some fairly interesting things happened in that time in your first term. One of them was breaking the hold of the old time kind of an what we could call an old boys network among the Democrats. And there was a kind of coup in the House where the leadership changed from a guy named Lester Ramsey.
Liston Ramsey.
To a more progressive Democrat. And there was obviously a move to – what role do you think you played in that coup, or if any?
Well, that happened right after the 88 election, in the December of 88, after the election. A couple of Democrats came to me and said that there's a group of us who are willing to form a coalition with Republicans, not on a ideological basis, but on a reform basis, to overthrow the speaker who had been in so long that he had absolute power. As you know what Lord Aston says about absolute power, corrupts absolutely. And so they said that they thought that they could get enough to be a majority if all the Republicans would go along with it. And I invited them to the governor's mansion, and we sat around the round table. So that's obvious for a nice cartoon, the Knights of the Table Round, with a group of the Republican leaders as well as the Democrat leaders. And we came to an agreement, or they did, came to an agreement that it would work if they would have a Democrat as Speaker, and that was Joe Mavretic, who they named, and he would have, the Republicans thought that would work, again, provided Republicans could chair some of the committees and be able to get their amendments and their bills considered. Before that, the deal was so rigid that they wouldn't even consider Republican bills and amendments. And the Democrats, the 20 that came over with us, were enough so that occasionally you might lose one or two on Republican or Democrat from that coalition, but you had enough to get most of the things through on a program.
We should point out that it was not just a Democratic, the lock of the Democratic Party, and it was, but it was a coalition within the Democrats that goes way back. And so the interests that were being served by that old boys network were extremely narrow, and I don't even think, you know, passed on to the entire Democratic constituency. So that breaks a lock, John Hood. But tell me about the milieu, too. We're talking about a time in which, you know, being called a liberal was a dirty word. Things were really changing. Tip O'Neill, while he had control, you talk about your last couple of years in Congress there, when Ronald Reagan was president, he was pretty much getting his way with a Democratic Congress. How much of that changing political landscape nationally do you think accounted for Jim Martin's success, electoral success? I don't mean his success within the state, but electoral success and this idea among Democrats that we better start changing our tune.
Well, there were clearly influences from the national political story. And in 1984, when Jim Martin was elected governor, there were many factors involved. Clearly, one of them was Ronald Reagan's popularity. He was reelected in a landslide in 84. But it's important to remember that while Martin was on the ballot with Ronald Reagan in 84 and won, lots of other Republicans were on the ballot with Ronald Reagan in 84 and lost. So it wasn't enough. It was helpful, but he needed to have, as he's been alluding to, a real agenda on things that people cared about, on education, on roads, on tax policy, on a variety of other matters. So it was an interesting lead. Jesse Helms, we mentioned this tension between these two. You have to have both the detachment and the attachment. There were also tensions between the Jesse Helms faction of the Republican Party and the Jim Martin faction. And there were some of these led to even literal fistfights, but certainly fights about the control of the party. But it's important to remember in 84, Jesse Helms endorsed Jim Hunt very early. Jim Martin very early. He would never have endorsed Jim Hunt as opponent. And this actually
to correct you.
Thank you. And this helped to clear the way for Jim Martin, whereas the Democrats had a very divisive primary. So there were a number of different factors, but I would think that being in Congress for 12 years, observing presidents who succeeded, like Reagan, and presidents who didn't always succeed, like a Jimmy Carter, did absolutely influence Jim Martin's performance as governor. Not all of it translated to the state context. It's different. Right. And he didn't have a Republican Senate, as Reagan did, to work with. He did have to work with Democrats controlling both chambers, and yet got a tremendous amount done during those 8 years.
Talked about compromises. Talk about some of the things that actually happened, including some tax cuts. You didn't get everything you wanted. You got about half in terms of some of the corporate tax cuts and a cut into the in a tax known as the intangibles tax. We won't go into detail on what that was. Talk about how that compromised. You got about half.
Well, intangibles was tax on your stocks, your bonds, right. Your savings account.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had already been taxed when you earned it, but right. It's going to be taxed again.
And inventories, yeah. Tax on business inventories.
Right.
That was the other
right.
thing.
That was the corporate one, yes.
How did that all come about? Talk about the compromise.
I served on the Ways and Means Committee in Congress for the last 10 of those 12 years. And although I didn't brag about this with my constituents, the Ways and Means Committee was responsible for tax policy. I just recall it the powerful Ways and Means Committee, and got away with it. But I did develop a philosophy about taxation and carried that over. And I thought that there were areas of the tax code in North Carolina, as I got into that part of my preparation to run, that were harmful to business. And if it's harmful to business, it'd be harmful to jobs. And if it's harmful to jobs, it's harmful to everybody, including revenue collections. And so I thought we needed to do away with those taxes that were particularly detrimental to creating jobs in the state.
You got them cut. And again, you got
yep.
about half of what you asked for.
Yep.
Let me ask you about another policy decision. You didn't get this. You wanted to privatize prisons. You still think that's a good idea?
I looked at it and thought about it and had no support for it, so I went back to the traditional way and built more prisons. The problem was how to get the money to build them, and with a legislature that would not respond favorably to my proposals at first, one of the ideas was, well, why don't we privatize them? But I have no problem with government meeting its responsibilities, and running prisons is one of those. The problem was the prisons were so overcrowded that people couldn't stay in there very long. And so the sentencing guidelines were ephemeral. I mean, they had very little vaporous. They had no effect on crime, and we needed to be able to put hardened criminals into prison for longer time. Well, one thing to do is get the others to come out, but you always have to have a prison cell waiting for them
yeah.
as a disciplinary device to be sure that they behave during their years after they're out of prison. So we did finally get support for a referendum, and it passed. Burley Mitchell was a Supreme Court Chief Justice, and he was very helpful and supportive on that.
Let me ask you now, often
a Democrat.
The current governor, Governor McCrory, a Republican, is often compared to you, and sometimes Jim Holzhauser, but because the preceding Republican governor is within memory. Although I think a more apt comparison for Governor McCrory would be Terry Sanford. In other words, a governor who has his party in power, not an oppositional legislature, and yet ideologically, or so he says, opposed, sort of fighting the tendencies. Terry Sanford, very successful in getting a reluctant, very conservative Democratic legislature to go along with his very progressive plans. Somehow he was able to lead and get what he wanted. Pat McCrory says, well, what can I do? These guys are elected too, and he seems not to be as effective getting what he wants. How would you compare the two?
Well, first of all, I don't know that I would agree with you on that. He had a rough first year, and he and I talked about that he should not take the legislature for granted. Hopefully they would look to his administration for ideas on some changes that were needed. But there'd been a pent-up wish on the part of these Republicans to get some things done that the Democrats would never allow them to vote on and do. And so they would have these omnibus bills that would have far too many things in them that hadn't been carefully considered. And my advice to him was, you know, respect their right to take the lead on some things, but to find the things that you need to stand for and do that. And I think he did. Had much more success in the second year and in this year, partly because he's been able to build relationships with the House leadership so that the bicameral legislature now has some different ideas to consider as to how to do things. And I think he's been influential on that.
When you left politics, it would seem to me that you sounded bitter and angry about the political profession. You surprised a lot of people by saying you weren't going to run. A lot of folks thought you might make a run for Senate. It was a surprise and a shock to hear how angry you were about the political milieu. At that time, you were under investigation. Your office was, the attorney general, the state's attorney was investigating, threatening an SBI investigation. Tell us about that and why you left politics and how you feel about politics today.
Well, first, let me tell you about the investigation so that people will understand. That was over the use of the state telephone by one of my campaign consultants who was in charge of ads. He's from California, and he made some calls back to his office. Should not have done it on the state telephones, and we paid, I think it was $17.51, something like that. It didn't run in the thousands, right. But we certainly paid it. And I thought it was heavy-handed on the part of the attorney general to make that kind of threat. But also part of it was I was in sick bed, had the flu, and had been taking some strong medicine that these days they tell you, don't take this if you're going to drive, or don't drive if you take it.
Or operate the heavy machinery.
And I responded, and it might have had some effect. But what it enabled me to do was to get out uninhibited to say that I had sincerely no interest in running for the Senate. And if the Democrats understood that, they would treat me fairly. And I think in the next couple of years, I was able to do a lot more with the House and Senate Democratic leadership because they no longer were threatened by my political future.
Jim Martin.
It was genuine. I was not going to run for Senate.
And you didn't. Governor Jim Martin served as governor of North Carolina from 1985 to 1993. Thank you so much for being here. And John Hood, conservative writer and political commentator who wrote the new biography Catalyst, Jim Martin and the Rise of the North Carolina Republicans. John, thank you.
You are certainly welcome.
They'll both talk about the book at a variety of events around the state in the coming months, including a talk at the North Carolina Museum of History in Raleigh tonight at 5:30 and an event at the Renaissance Hotel in Asheville on Tuesday, October 27th. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a new book by Duke Law Professor Jed Purdy, Life After Nature. Stay with us.